Session number 16900, Vera Elkan, reel 7.
Mrs. Vera Morley, and this would be reel 7. Yes, you were telling me about this occasion.
Well, we arrived in Windermere and all assembled on the station, and the person who was meeting us to take us to Bowness looked round and saw that I was the only one with crowns and said, "Will you please march all these people down to Bowness?" I said, "I've never marched anybody anywhere in my life." And this surprised her very much, because most people had drill. And while most people at West Kingstown had drill, my watch didn't, because I hated it and I was determined not to. And I spoke to our WAF commander, who was the daughter of Conan Doyle. She was our WAF admin officer. And I said, "Ma'am, if I grow the vegetables with my watch for the whole of the unit, can we be let off drill?" And we had to crawl through the barbed wire, and I was much too thin and light to get a spade into the virgin ground then. And we had a very heavy, big WAF called Liz Larter, who could just stood one foot on the spade and it went in like butter. And she dug it all up, and we planted lots and lots of vegetables, and we were let off drill. So I never learned how to drill, and I never wanted to either. So there I was with about 30 people, and I formed them up, or I was helped to form them up, and we started to march. And little did I know that there was also an officer's advanced training course. And the whole way down from Windermere to Bowness, we met officers parading up and down, going for walks, and they all had to be saluted, which I did. But very often I forgot to say eyes front again. So they were all walking with their heads crooked. And then I forgot to get their hands down from saluting, and it was altogether a mess. When we arrived in Bowness, my crowns were taken away, which I didn't like at all, because I got more money when I had crowns. And we were then drill, but we also had lots and lots of other lessons, like King's regulations and Air Ministry orders that were called AMOs. And I don't remember what we learned there, but a lot. And it was several weeks. And in between, in our free time, we hired bicycles and cycled round Lake Windermere and across Rhino's Pass. And it was very pleasant. It was summer. And come the last evening, everybody in my dormitory was terribly nervous and said, "Oh, I'll fail tomorrow, oh, I'll fail tomorrow." And I went round calming them all down. It never occurred to me that I could fail. It literally didn't. And I said, "Oh, we'd all had interviews with the WAF CO, and mine was very political, and I was very left-wing, and we almost quarreled in this interview."
Who was the WAF CO?
No idea. I wouldn't remember one from another. You know, they were all such really insignificant people. And there I was, calming them down, and one or two other people calming others down and saying, "You'll be all right." And they were. And who failed? I did, and the other two failed too. And I think I failed because of my political interview, or because I couldn't do drill. I always marched them straight into the nearest wall. I just wasn't any good at it. So they sent me to Chicksands. Now, Chicksands was only WT, and had absolutely nothing to do with our unit at all. And when I was given the posting papers, I said, you know, I don't belong there. I have to go back to my unit. No, you can't do that. We never send people back to where they came from. So I rang the CO from Chicksands, and I said, Mr. Bunch, please rescue me. And he said, what are you doing there? And I said, I've failed the OCTU. He couldn't believe it. I couldn't either. And he rescued me after about a week. I did nothing there at all. And I went back to my unit, minus my crowns, and I got those back. And then I think I don't remember quite where I, whether what the sequence was, whether I then went to Galston or whether I then went to Montrose. I think I then went to Montrose, and he gave me Montrose. And while I was up there, it was all very satisfactory, and I enjoyed it very much. But my poor dog got run over and killed the one night I was away. That was heartbreaking. He was called Bianco, and I loved him dearly, and everybody loved him. But he'd taken it into his head that we didn't give him enough to eat, and he used to go to the Polish camp, and he got run over on the road. It was terrible. But I was in Aberdeen that night, and they rang me up, and they buried him before I got back. Thank goodness. I was the only one who had a dog in the whole unit.
Was that usual that you?
No, not at all. Not at all. But I said to the CO, I must have him because I've got nowhere else to leave him. And whereupon the CO said, all right. And I went to fetch him. And by the time I got back, the CO thought she's not going to be the only one with a dog. And he had also bought one. And he had a little dog called Herr Winkler, who was named after one of the German call signs. And Herr Winkler and Bianco didn't like each other very much. It's very funny. They didn't fight, but they just didn't like each other.
You mentioned Conan Doyle, the your superior.
Yeah.
Is that right? Under her?
Yeah, well, yes. I wasn't under her, only indirectly. She was the WAF admin officer. She had nothing to do with German. But she did try to learn Morse when we all tried, but I certainly couldn't learn it at all. It's not my sort of thing. We had sort of extra classes, and she did all sorts of things that weren't right. Like, for instance, she searched our belongings because somebody had stolen something while we weren't standing there, whereas we were supposed to. So we all rebelled. You weren't allowed to rebel in a mass against an officer. We weren't officers then. You had to do it singly. So we queued up in the corridor, and we all said the same thing, you see. And by the time it got to me and my friend Ursula, she got fed up with us because she'd heard it too many times. And she came out into the corridor, I remember, and she said, are you all going to say the same thing? And we said, yes, ma'am. And she said, well, I've understood it now, so you can go away. So we didn't have to repeat it. And I don't think she ever did it again. You know, she wasn't, after all. None of us were soldiers. We didn't know about all these disciplines. For instance, when I was in Montrose, she was very nice, extremely nice. She rang up one day and said she was coming up to see the unit because by then I'd changed everything completely and made it livable. And we dreaded this. So the others said, for heaven's sake, the train arrived about 7 o'clock in the morning. For heaven's sake, don't bring her out to the unit before a reasonable hour. So I took her to a hotel to give her breakfast. She wore a monocle. And I thought I'd better break it to her how we were living, which was quite un-WAF-like. You know, we had lots to eat, and altogether we knew the fishermen, we knew everybody. And it was no problem at all. And we had ordered lobsters for her for lunch, and we were going to be nice to her so that she wouldn't object to all the things we were doing. And I thought I'd better tell her about some of these things. And so I breakfasted porridge, big bowl of porridge. I started to tell her, and her monocle fell plonk into the porridge. Never forgotten it. Anyhow, by then she was quite human. And she came out to the unit, and she thought it was wonderful the way we were living. And I suspect during that time she'd forgotten she was the highest WAF in our unit. And she even washed up. It was remarkable. But then Group decided to descend on us. That was quite a different story. And Group said, "Flight, where do you keep your AMOs?" I looked at great astonishment, and I said, "What are AMOs?" And they came every week or something, and I just shoved them into a drawer. I never opened them even. And they explained to me that they were sort of King's regulations, and you had to know, like, for instance, they wanted us to dig trenches. Well, it was all sand. How can you dig a trench in sand? That I happened to know because they rang up from Kingston and told me to do it, but I said, we can't. We couldn't. I opened this drawer, and they were terribly shocked that I didn't know that I should have opened them. You know, those sort of things. But that was different. C.D. behaved herself very well that visit. Then, at some stage, they sent for me, and I had to go for... Yes, I was in Montrose, of course. At some point, when I was in Montrose, I was posted back to West Kingston, except they were then... I'm really not quite sure about the sequence of events, but something like this. They were then in Canterbury because they'd had a flying bomb in West Kingston. And they were in the... Is it called the King's School in Canterbury? And I was on watch at night... And the CEO said to me, "You're incorrectly dressed." And I said, "Sir, I'm not." And I wasn't, for a flight sergeant. And he said, "Yes, you are. You just got your commission." And it came absolutely out of the blue. Go and have a sleep. And tomorrow morning, you and two others... we'll go up to town and get your uniform, which fortunately the tailor had kept from the Octo, because they must have known that most people get it eventually. And then come back properly dressed. So it's still not right, you know, the sequence of events, but something like this. We went up to town the next morning, and the tailor had to find my uniform, so it wasn't there, but they gave me a raincoat, and it was a boiling hot day, and I can remember I went into John Bell and Croydon to get something in my ordinary uniform and a raincoat and the cap I had, and I met some people I knew. And they said, "Why on earth are you dressed like that? You must be boiling." And I said, "I am boiling." But I didn't want to tell them what had happened. And the next day, I think I got my uniform and then I went... No, and then comes a bit which I don't remember where it fitted in. Then I was sent to Air Ministry for a special interview. And there were two people there. One was called Rosemary, something like Horsnell, or Horsfall, and one was a wing commander, whose name I don't know. And they said to me, "Would you be willing to be dropped over Germany and do some secret, really secret work. And I said, any time, without thinking. No, I was still at Montrose, this was before, because now I remember. I will do anything to beat the Nazis. It's only when I got home that I thought of the implications of this and how I would behave if I got caught, which you can't tell beforehand. And I have a feeling that I wouldn't be so good, but I don't know. Maybe I would be a hero. Who knows? And I said, yes. And so they gave me a sheaf of papers. And in those, you had to fill in all sorts of things. But before that, I had to have a medical. So I went back to where, opposite, I think, where the medical people were. And among other things, I had to produce a sample in a little bottle. And this I can't do if I know somebody's waiting. And I was there the entire afternoon, drinking cups of tea, one after another, and nothing happened. So they said, well, too bad. We can't be open all day and all night. You'll have to take all these papers back to Montrose, and we will then let you know when to have you. So, and you will send us a sample which the medical officer up there can see, and then you will hear from us. And I spent a week filling in these papers. It was every street you knew in Hamburg, for example, which I knew best. Berlin I knew quite well, but not that well. Every grandparent, great-grandparent, who they were, what they did, everything. It was incredibly detailed. And I filled all that in, and I sent the sample off, and I never heard from them again. And eventually I got my commission, and then I was posted to Goldston, and we had a very interesting time there.
Where was that? Goldston?
Goldston. No, Goldston. G-O-R-L-E-S-T-O-N, near Great Yarmouth. We were always on the coast, you see. And that was a much bigger unit. And I had to put WAF on charge, which I wasn't very good at. And we always got the giggles. And I think the CO, who was called Tudor, very nice man, but not a great lad. I don't know what's happened to him. And he... I don't think he approved of me being in charge of so many WAF. However,
was it the same sort of work, was it?
Oh, yes, well, it's always the same. Yes. It wasn't all... I mean, Liz, for instance, if you did get hold of her and if she wanted to talk, would probably tell you a different angle, because I was on this particular bit because of my German, I suppose, and because I was quick at it, and I loved it. I didn't really want to change. My war was very nice. But when in Goldston, towards the end of the war, one thing we were absolutely forbidden was to fly and to go in boats in case we got captured. And in Goldston, we became friendly with Great Yarmouth, RAF, what were they? The boats, you know, that went out into the North Sea and picked up airmen. And, of course, we went with them. And it was towards the end of the war. And I got nearly to Holland one day with them. And it was terrific fun. We never found any airmen when I was on board, but they did. They picked up quite a few. Then war ended, and we were all posted to White Waltham, which is in the Thames Valley somewhere, near Maidenhead, somewhere up there. And that was very boring. And nobody knew what to do with us. And I was giving bridge lessons and somebody else was giving something else, you know, just to pass the time. And then I was suddenly posted to Bad Nauheim, to the American sector, which was the American intelligence sector which Galbraith ran. And they had captured what was called the Hamburg documents. And the Hamburg documents were all Alfred Speer's documents. It was a... Bad Nauheim was a spa and had these narrow treatment rooms. They were all filled to the ceiling with documents. And this other girl, who wasn't from our unit, but spoke German, and I were supposed to bring back as much of these documents, information of them, or abstracts, or whatever we could, for air ministry here. Well, of course, we took one horrified look at this lot and said, where do we start? But the first thing we did, we got into the aeroplane. It was an old Dakota with seats, bucket seats down the sides, and full of Americans and us. And the pilot saw he had two girls on board, and he wanted to show off, so he said we could come in the cockpit. So we went in the cockpit, and when we got to Cologne, when we got to the Ruhr, down we went to have a look at all the damage, up we went. Cologne, down we went, up we went. When we finally got out at Frankfurt, there were an awful lot of very green Americans. And we said, what's the matter? It was a very nice flat. Oh, no, it wasn't. It was terribly rough, they said. And that was us being shown Germany. Still, we got to this place, saw all these documents, and decided this was a dead loss. And there were 200 American intelligence officers there. And some of them were quite well known. And among others, that's where I met Fritz Schumacher, who was a darling. And we got on like a horse on fire because we knew a lot of the same people. And Kathleen, this other girl, fell in love with one American, which left 199 for me, which I didn't want, because Fritz and I got on so well. And he took me everywhere. And among other things, we went for long walks in the woods around Bad Nauheim. And there were all these little fires and DPs sitting around them on their way to wherever they came from. It was so sad. Then we went down to Heidelberg, and that was full of DPs, all looking at the castle. And then we went a bit further towards Freiburg. And there we met Chris Bielenberg, whose husband was in the plot against Hitler. And no, we didn't meet her. I mean, we went to see her. And she invited us for a meal, and she was a friend of Fritz's. And the husband wasn't there that day, but the boys were. They live in Ireland now, and she still broadcasts and still writes. She is English, and he wasn't. He was German. And she lived the whole war in Berlin and wrote a very interesting book about it, which you may have seen.
What sort of condition were they in when you saw them? Were they sort of beginning to pull their lives together after the war?
The Bielendorfs? Oh, they were, yes, because Chris was all right, you see. I mean, she was English. And she probably through, I don't know really the details, but through that she probably knew that they could come get out. But the other Germans were doormats. It was appalling. Nobody had been a Nazi. They would exchange anything they possessed for a bit of coffee or a packet of cigarettes. We had to interview people from the camp, the prisoner of war camp near there. And one of the people I had to interview was a man called Wagenführer, who was Speer's second in command.
What was his name? Wagen?
Wagenführer.
W-A...
W-A-G-E-N F-U-H-E-H-R,
oh, yes.
I should think. Wagenführer.
Mm.
He sat beside me, and he'd been, after all, a very high-up Nazi. I don't say that he was a high-up German, but he certainly was a high-up Nazi. If I put a cigarette out, he would take the stub. It was horrid, absolutely horrid. And after about two or three days wandering around Bad Nauheim, I came across a room full of microfilm apparatus. I'd never done that one before. And I went to the person in charge and I said, could I have one of the machines? Because that way I thought we could bring a lot back. And he said, no, they were all fully occupied. But a few days later he came to me and he said, yes, you can have one for a few days. And we had a wonderful time. We just grabbed handfuls, we couldn't sort them out, of documents. Kathleen fed them through and I filmed. And we had reels and reels of film.
Had you any idea what the documents
no,
were?
No,
did
we
you
just,
read any of them?
No, we couldn't. You didn't have time. When you're confronted by miles, absolutely miles of documents. I don't know that they were all Speer personally. You know that they were his archives. So when I finally got back to London, they were very pleased with all these reels of film. And I got to Monk Street. I got posted to Monk Street, which was, I don't know what it was exactly. The whole object was to find out whether the bombing we'd done had done any good or had helped shorten the war or hadn't, and it obviously hadn't. You know, we
how
bombed.
Did you, yes, how did they go about
I've
trying
no
to find that?
No really? Idea. Have I you... had nothing to do with that.
But
I should think if
they
found what they wanted to find, I should think.
Which was that it hadn't done any...
No, they would say that it had, I expect. I mean, Harris thought he was doing the right thing, didn't he? We thought we were doing the right thing. We all thought we were doing the right thing. But in fact, look, I went to Hamburg last year. Now, it's a town that I do know fairly well, or as a child. But I remembered it, and it's a beautiful town. They had rebuilt it so that you really didn't know that we'd been there. And there are very, very few high-rise buildings allowed, so that the old warehouses look exactly as though they'd been there 500 years. They're used, not like here. They're full of spices. The smell is gorgeous. You see the carpets from the Orient hanging there when you pass. It's extraordinary. The only thing they have done, look, that is a picture of Hamburg. And that's how it looked when I was a child, and that's how it still looks. Some of the churches have not been rebuilt and have gone. The canals, which go from the Alster down to the Elbe, there were seven when I was there as a child. They filled them in with all the rubble from the Blitz. They practically flattened Hamburg. They filled them all in, and only three exist now. So that's different. And they've made roads over them. They in the harbour, the containers arrive roughly every 5 to 10 minutes from all over the world. Huge, enormous ships. They get unloaded. They have an area called St. Pauli, which is the sort of red light district, more or less, with all the funfairs and everything.